Thank you for standing by. This is the conference operator. Welcome to the Annual and Special Meeting of Shareholders for Aurenia Resources conference call. As a reminder, all participants are in listen-only mode, and the conference is being recorded. After the presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. To join the question queue, you may press star then one on your telephone keypad. Should you need assistance during the conference call, you may signal an operator by pressing star and zero. I would now like to turn the conference over to Dr. Keith Barron, Chairman and CEO of Aurenia Resources. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Annual and Special Meeting of the Shareholders of Aurenia Resources Limited. I'm Keith Barron, the Chairman, the CEO, and Director of the company. And with your permission, the management has scheduled the following for today's meeting. Number one, the formal business of the meeting will be conducted first. And number two, at the conclusion of the formal business, our President, Dr. Richard Spencer, and I will hold a question and answer period. So we have five items of business to conduct today. These items are all outlined in the Management Information Circular dated April 30th, 2020. Item number one, to place the company's audited financial statements for the year ended December 31st, 2019, together with the auditor's report thereon before the meeting. Number two, to appoint UHY McGovern Hurley LLP Chartered Accountants as the auditors of the company for the ensuing year and to authorize the directors to fix their remuneration. Number three, to elect the directors of the company for the ensuing year. Number four, to approve the company's incentive stock option plan for the upcoming year. And number five, to transact such other business as may properly come before the meeting or any adjournments or postponements thereof. Once the formal business of the meeting has been completed, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. So I will now call the meeting to order. In accordance with the bylaws of the company, I shall preside as chairman of this meeting. I shall ask Carolyn Muir to act as secretary of the meeting. And unless there is an objection, I shall ask Lori Winchester of TSX Trust Company to act as scrutineer for the meeting. The secretary has advised me that the notice of meeting, together with a form of proxy, Management Information Circular, and request form, have been provided to, as applicable, each director of the company, the auditors of the company, and provided to each shareholder of the company of record on April 30th, 2020, the record date for the meeting. An affidavit of mailing has been provided by TSX Trust Company to the company, and I direct that the affidavit be annexed to the minutes of the meeting. Accordingly, unless there is an objection, I will dispense with the reading of the notice of meeting. The scrutineer has provided me with a preliminary report regarding shareholders, shareholder attendance and representation at this meeting. The scrutineer reports that there are present at this meeting in person or by proxy 107 shareholders holding 4,082,278 common shares. Accordingly, I declare that the requisite quorum of shareholders is present, and I declare that the meeting is duly and properly constituted for the transaction of business. I direct that the scrutineer's complete report on attendance be annexed to the minutes of the meeting. To the best of my belief, the votes against represented by proxy on a ballot in respect of any item of business before this meeting represent less than 5% of all votes that might be cast in respect of such item of business. Therefore, each vote will be conducted by a show of hands, absent a shareholder demand for a ballot. If a ballot is required, all registered shareholders or proxy nominees present who have not previously submitted a proxy will be provided with a form of ballot. I will direct at the appropriate time that such persons mark their ballot for collection and tabulation by the scrutineers. There are several matters that must be dealt with during this formal part of the meeting. In order to expedite these matters, I have requested that certain persons make and second the formal motions, and I will call on these persons at the appropriate time. Shareholders may make comments specific to these motions prior to the vote. but should hold any comments on general matters until the question period to be held following the termination of the meeting. As the first item of business, the company's audited financial statements for the year ended December 31st, 2019, and the auditor's report thereon are hereby placed before the meeting. We will now proceed with the appointment of the auditors of the company. Unless a shareholder or proxy holder entitled to vote at this meeting request a ballot, I shall conduct the vote by a show of hands in order to expedite the voting. I would ask someone to move the following resolution, which I will now read. Be it hereby resolved that UHY McGovern Hurley LLP Chartered Accountants be and they are hereby appointed as auditors of the company to hold office until the close of the next annual meeting of shareholders or until their successors are appointed at such remuneration as may be fixed by the directors, and the directors be and they are hereby authorized to fix such remuneration.
Alfred Lenarczyk, so I move the option, the motion.
May I have the motion seconded, please?
Yes, I second the motion, Richard Spencer.
I declare that the resolution appointing the auditors of the company for the ensuing year and authorizing the directors to fix their remuneration has been carried. We will now proceed with the election of directors of the company for the ensuing year. In the management information circular of the company dated April 30th, 2020, on pages 22 to 25, it was indicated that the company will propose 6 persons for election as directors. Accordingly, management nominates the following persons as specified in the management information circular delivered with the notice of meeting, namely myself, Dr. Keith M. Barron, Warren Gilman, Jonathan Kagan, Dr. Richard Spencer, Alfred Lenarczyk, and Dr. Leanne Baker, to be elected to serve as directors of the company to hold office until the next annual meeting of shareholders, or until their successors are duly elected or appointed in accordance with the articles and bylaws of the company. Are there any further nominations? Since there are no further nominations, I hereby declare the nominations closed. I have been advised by the scrutineer that the proxies deposited for the meeting have been voted for the election of each of the directors, and I would ask someone to move the following resolution, which I will now read. Be it hereby resolved that the 6 persons nominated by management be elected as directors of the company to hold office until the close of the next annual meeting of shareholders or until their successors are duly elected or appointed in accordance with the articles and the bylaws of the company.
Alfred Lenarczyk, I so move the motion.
Thank you. May I have a seconder, please?
I second the motion, Richard Spencer.
Thank you very much. I declare that the resolution to elect Dr. Keith M. Barron, Warren Gilman, Jonathan Kagan, Dr. Richard Spencer, Alfred Lenarczyk, and Dr. Leanne Baker as directors of the company to hold office until the close of the next annual meeting of shareholders or until their successors are duly elected or appointed has been carried. We now proceed with the ordinary resolution approving the company's incentive stock option plan as described on page 25 of the Management Information Circular under the heading Approval of Option Plan for Upcoming Year. A full description of the stock option plan is set out on pages A1 to A8 of the Management Information Circular under the heading Schedule A Stock Option Plan. This resolution is an ordinary resolution that requires the approval of at least a majority of the votes cast thereon by the shareholders in person or by proxy at the meeting. The Board of Directors of the company recommends that shareholders vote in favor of this resolution and believes that the passing of this resolution is in the best interest of the company. I would ask someone to move the following resolution, which I will now read. Be it hereby resolved as an ordinary resolution of shareholders of the company that, number one, the share incentive plan of the company described in the Management Information Circular of the company, dated April 30th, 2020, be and the same is hereby ratified, confirmed, and approved as the stock option plan of the company. And number two, any director or officer of the company is hereby authorized and directed for and in the name of and on behalf of the company to execute or cause to be executed whether under corporate seal of the company or otherwise, and to deliver or cause to be delivered all such documents, and to do or cause to be done all such acts and things, as in the opinion of such director or officer may be necessary or desirable in connection with the foregoing resolution.
I so move the motion, Alfred Lenarchuk.
May I have the motion seconded, please?
I second the motion, Richard Spencer.
Thank you very much. Scrutineer reports that the resolution has been duly carried by a majority of the shareholder votes cast at the meeting, and I accordingly declare the resolution approving the company's incentive stock option plan has been carried. Is there any other formal business that may be properly brought before this meeting? If not, that concludes the formal business brought before the meeting, and I wish to thank you for attending, and I would now ask for a motion that this meeting be terminated.
I move that this meeting be terminated, Alfred Lenarchuk.
And I second the motion, Richard Spencer.
Thank you very much. I hereby declare the motion carried and the meeting terminated. So we will now open up the floor to answer any questions that you may have about the company.
Anastasia, can you open up for questions, please?
Certainly.
Thanks.
We will now begin the question and answer session. To join the question queue, you may press star, then one on your telephone keypad. You will hear a tone acknowledging your request. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing any keys. To withdraw your question, please press star, then two. We will pause for a moment as callers join the queue. There are no questioners at this time. This concludes the question and answer session.
Anastasia, just hold on. Let's just keep it open for a minute because we're quite a bit earlier than we expected to be.
No problem.
Thanks.
Everyone's playing golf.
We do have one question, and it's coming from Mark Reichman with Noble Capital Markets. Please go ahead. Mr. Mark Reichman, your line is live.
Yes, good afternoon. Wanted to just ask if maybe you might be able to provide just kind of a brief update on the project in Ecuador, how things are progressing in terms of the work restrictions in Ecuador and maybe the immediate next steps for the projects.
Do you want to handle that, Richard?
Okay, Keith, I'll start and then you can go for it. Mark, thanks. We've had on slide four that's on the webcast, but it's also on the website for the Q&A session. That just shows a graphic of the COVID situation in Ecuador. And our project is down in the Morona Santiago province, which has got the number 179 in it, in the sort of southeast or lower right of that map of Ecuador. So 179 confirmed cases. The curve had started to flatten there, and it's starting to rise again a little bit. But I think that's mainly because of the deeper extent of the testing in that area. And the local mayors are starting to open up the area to work. So as of earlier this week, as of Monday, we're allowed back into the Makas field office, and the guys are in there operating out of there. So we're moving up to 50% strength. Our first field teams will be ready to head into the field. We said in the press release on today, on the 10th, but in fact, there's been a slight delay because of some new COVID cases in one of the areas that we wanted to go into. So they will be going in on the 13th. And yeah, so we are starting to access the area as of this weekend. And, you know, we're obviously being extremely cautious. We've got a very conservative protocol in place. Everyone that's going into the field is having a subjected to a COVID test, and then they go into quarantine while they wait for those results, so that we know that everyone who's heading to the field is clean. And yeah, so that's basically the approach that we're taking. In terms of the project as a whole, we are pretty excited about the one of the copper targets, and in fact, if we just go on to page 11 of that presentation, there was a press release about the Senken N2 and N3 area a couple of weeks ago, and that is the area that we're prioritizing to do some work on in the very short term, get it ready for scout drilling. And in fact, on the next page, on page 12, that's a sort of vertical slice through that target area, and it just depicts what we're expecting to see. We're expecting to see a hybrid of sort of copper related to porphyries, sort of granitic bodies that are coming into the sediments and then mineralizing the sediments as well with copper and silver. In terms of the gold exploration, Yowie and Crunchy Hill are still looking good. We would like to do some geophysics there, and as Keith mentioned in his shareholder letter, we're a little bit reticent about getting field teams into that area at the moment because there's a little bit of a COVID hotspot there. So we'll hold off on that just until we can really assess the situation. And but there at Yowie particularly, we think that there's a porphyry and a couple of epithermal gold-silver targets. So that's going to be the main focus of our exploration going forward, the Senken N2 and N3 copper-silver target and Yowie as well once we can get the geophysics done. Mark, does that answer what you wanted to have covered, or is there anything else?
Oh, absolutely.
Else?
Yeah, that's very helpful. And then just one other thing, in terms of the imagery for the historic roads, has your thoughts or your thinking evolved on the findings in terms of the historical infrastructure that may be related to the historic gold mining centers?
Mark, yes. You know, and I'll put in the caveat right at the beginning. We always got to be a little bit cautious on this because any finding that we have is obviously reported to the Ecuadorian government. You know, we don't want them to get excited unduly about something. So our reporting is always pretty cautious, and you know, we need to get in and field check these things. But certainly the LIDAR is showing an infrastructure that is a little more extensive than we expected to see. But again, that comes with the caveat that these things need to be field checked. But yeah, you know, we are seeing a network of roads, and we haven't come across the lost cities yet. However, you know, the roads that we think that we can see on the light are you know, heading pretty much in one, they're sort of converging on one area, which is pretty much where Keith and JP, our exploration vice president, always thought that Logroño was located. So yes, we're making very, very good progress, but you know, I'll just repeat that we need to be very reticent about our reporting from a sort of Ecuadorian government perspective. We need to be really sure that we've seen something on the ground before we announce it and get the government people involved.
And I think if I might just add, when Richard said that we're going to 50% strength in the field, that's actually mandated by law. We're not allowed to have more than 50% of our people active in the company right now, including in the office. So there's similar sorts of situation now in many countries. And of course, we have to maintain the social distancing and all the other things that have to be done to minimize the chances of anyone getting infected. And of course, we're being very, very careful with our protocol to ensure that no people who are carrying any of this stuff are getting anywhere close to the field. If I might return back to slide number 12 in the presentation, I just wanted to explain one little thing here. Up on the top left, you'll see a color image. And very cleverly, Jean-Paul has put the LIDAR together with the geophysics, with the magnetic signature. So the high mag stuff is the violet color you can see. And the soil geochemistry is overlaying on top of that. And you can see those little green dots, that's where we've taken the samples. And in the previous slide, you can see that most of those grids are lighting up very, very much in terms of copper. But the thing that's interesting, we've had a little bit of an epiphany regarding this. You'll see that on the eastern side of the image, on the right-hand side of the image, there's something right at the end of the section line that's sticking up. And that's actually a cliff of rock. It's called the Hoyin Formation. It's Cretaceous in age, and it postdates the porphyries. It's later than the porphyries. It lies on top of them. And in the conceptual cross-section, you can see on the right-hand side, it says overlying strata, and it's here in green. Now, that's very important because to the south, in the Condor Belt, there is obviously one operating mine, Mirador, and then there's Barenza, which is a pretty advanced target. And both of these things have what are called supergene blankets. And I've mentioned this in my letter to shareholders. It is quite possible that underneath the overlying strata, we might have the supergene blanket on top of the N3 porphyry preserved. And in fact, it might be preserved on both N2 and N3. So this is very, very interesting for us. It kind of opens up a whole bunch of new possibilities because the supergene blanket tends to have 3 to 5 times the grade of the underlying porphyry. And it is the thing that makes these things economic or potentially economic. So it's very important. If you've got them, it's a bit of a game changer. So that's what I wanted to add. Thank you.
And Keith, just adding to that, Mark. Just, you know, if you look at slide 11, where the N3 is written, You can see the geophysical anomaly, that magnetic body continuing there, and it looks as though there's no copper in the soils, and in fact there is no copper in the soils, because that area is where the copper dies off, is exactly where those younger rocks come in and cover the porphyry targets, and that's why on page 12 we've drawn the porphyry under those rocks. So, you know, it basically says that copper anomaly that we're seeing in the soils is likely to be quite a lot more extensive and continuous from the one side of the hill to the other. And thanks for clarifying that, Keith.
That's very helpful. Thank you very much.
Our next question comes from Ronald Shore with Shore Capital. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, guys. Has the COVID-19 pandemic died out around Guayaquil? And do your employees and service providers use the airport at Cuenca? Is that highly accessible for you people instead of having to go through Guayaquil?
Ron, sorry, Keith, let me just jump in here.
Okay.
And Ron, yeah, Guayaquil was a little bit of a hot spot. Having said that, I think that a lot of the imagery that was shown in the early days of this pandemic was over the top. I think there was something bizarre going on with that reporting, and I don't think some of that imagery was true or represented the real mm-hmm. situation. However, it was the sort of center of the area or of the pandemic in Ecuador. But Guayaquil and that Guayas province has now opened up again to the same status as our province, 50% of people back at work. So they are through the main part of the crisis. There was a stage about a month back when the city hospitals were overwhelmed, but it's now under control. And, you know, that is the industrial center of Ecuador, and it's now opening up. Only one of our employees comes from Guayaquil, and you can bet that she is being vetted. She's getting double tested for COVID. And in fact, everyone else comes from Quito and other cities around the area. But our protocol is that anyone that's from outside of the Morona-Santiago province where our project is have to be tested, and then they go into a four-day quarantine for us to get the results back and double-checked and everything before they head down to the field office of Macas. So we're being pretty conservative. But, yeah, Guayaquil is fortunately through the worst of the crisis and starting to get back to normal.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and Ron, we're not using Cuenca Airport. In fact, it's still a situation where it is very difficult for foreigners to go into Ecuador. So we're mm-hmm. we're waiting for the green light, but it's really a situation where the government still is reluctant to allow foreigners in, or even Ecuadorians who are repatriating, unless there's you know, there's some sort of a special circumstance. In order to get to the field, we don't use airports. We actually drive from Quito usually. Through to Macas, so we go by road.
How many hours is that, Keith?
Depending on whether you stop for lunch, it'll be 5 to 7.
I see. And isn't Cuenca, if it was available, 3 or 4 hours away?
You know, I don't think Cuenca has an airport.
Like,
in fact, if it does, I've never used it.
I'm pretty sure it does. Yeah.
For 20
Ron,
years, yeah.
Yeah, Ron, sorry. Yeah, we don't use Cuenca. In fact, a lot of our COVID testing is being done in Cuenca, so we're now traveling between Macas and Cuenca in some situations, and it's a 5-hour drive. But we don't come through Cuenca typically, because by the time it's actually shorter to drive from Quito to Macas, which is the 7 hours that Keith was talking about, rather than get to the airport an hour before your flight, then, you know, have your luggage lost and all the rest of it, and the flight time, you know, it ends up actually being more efficient just to drive directly from Quito. And the other thing is that, you know, during this crisis, obviously, we are using vehicles that are decontaminated, cleaned up, and you know that happens every time a passenger has been in that vehicle. It gets cleaned and sprayed down, and that way we can control our environment and control the safety of our people as well. We're trying to keep out of airports and minimize our contact with crowds as much as possible, obviously.
Is there any indication as to when you might be able to utilize 100% of your employees instead of 50%?
Ron, no, it's not really clear yet, but, you know, it doesn't really affect us all that badly, because all of our teams were on rotations anyway. We've always sort of worked that way. You know, so because the field conditions are rough, so, you know, look, I mean, typically 70% of our people are in the field at any one time, we're working at a slightly reduced pace, but in fact, you know, because the field teams are in such isolated locations, once they're through and supplied and everything and in the field, we can then sort of replace those people in preparing in the office and all that. So, you know, in fact, the real operational effect on this on the company is not as big as one might expect. In other words, we will be operating at almost full strength very, very soon.
That sounds great. Thanks a lot, guys.
Okay. Thank you.
Guys, sorry, we've got a question in from Nicolas Perez in Quito in Ecuador. He just couldn't get through on the line, and he's asking some fundamental questions. Hi, Nicolas. Cash position at the end of Q1, we were at 5.1 million. We are burning around about $500,000 a month, so that will last us about 10 months or so. However, you know, we're excited about the targets that we're seeing. This downtime where we haven't been able to race around the field has actually given us an unusual opportunity to really sharpen our pencils on the targets and really refine them. And you know, the geophysics that Keith mentioned in his annual letter and everything, that would push up our costs. So it really just depends on the extent to which we do the geophysics and that kind of thing, because that would cut back the time that the cash that we have is going to last us. So it really, you know, it's going at current rates about 10 months. But in fact, if we push harder than that in the field, obviously the cash will run out a little bit sooner. Nicholas, if you can just message Carolyn if you need anything else answered or if I haven't answered correctly. And then there's another question also out of Quito near-term expiration plans and timeline. So I think the easiest thing is if we can go down to slide 18 in the presentation. You know, we've divided the next steps into the gold, silver, copper, silver, and copper, gold. So under the gold, silver section, we are continuing with the LIDAR analysis. And as Keith mentioned, we are reprocessing some of the LIDAR to bring out some of the what we believe to be colonial Spanish infrastructure. And you'll notice that we are starting to use that word infrastructure as opposed to odd roads and things. We think that we're seeing something that was relatively sophisticated. And then the Crunchy Hill and Yowie targets, which are the ones where we did the scout drilling. We missed on the scout drilling, but in fact, you know, the scout drilling was still absolutely crucial in giving us vectors towards where the sort of heart of the mineralizing system is. And the field work that's followed up on that, on those vectors is really showing us, you know, sort of confirming those vectors. So we will do more work on Yowie and Crunchy Hill towards scout drilling there again. On the copper silver, I've talked about Senken N2 and N3. And in fact, on that graphic, there's an N4 that is a looks like a porphyry target to the north. That's on page 13, I think it is. Let me just check. On page 11. So we will probably extend some of the work up into that area while we're doing the scout drilling on N2 and N3. And there again, you know, as Keith mentioned, we're looking at a porphyry target, a porphyry copper target, as well as the sedimentary hosted or the relatively sort of flat-lying copper silver mineralization. And then another very big anomaly and very striking magnetic area from the geophysics is called Kiris, which we believe again is a porphyry target. We'll start doing some very basic work in that area towards scout drilling there. And then on the copper gold, we have the sort of central northern part of the concession area, an area called Awacha, where we believe we have a cluster of porphyries. And the interesting thing about those is that, you know, porphyries are principally copper deposits, but there's a type of porphyry that also has gold in it. And we believe that Awacha is that sort of second category that has copper and gold. So it's a copper gold target. And in terms of timeline of getting into these things, I mean, we want to get into Senken N2 and N3 yesterday. That will be one of the first areas that we're heading into. The teams that are going in on Saturday are going into the Yowie area, but then there'll be another set of teams that go in a week later, around about the 20th, and they'll be heading into Senken N2 and 3 and preparing that for scout drilling. And another question has come in. Sorry, Keith, I'm in anything that you want to add? Karen is just reading me messages that are coming in from Ecuador.
You're fine. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry, another question in from Ecuador is whether the 500,000 a month burn rate includes the drilling. No, it doesn't include the drilling. So once we start drilling, that number will go up. However, I should just point out that the Senken N2 and N3 is quite a remote area, and we would be using a very, very lightweight drill rig, which is in-country. It belongs to the contractors that we used at Crunchy Hill and Yowie, a company from Yellowknife called Kloane Drilling. And in fact, on page 12, which is the slice through the Sync N2 and N3 targets, those little black vertical lines coming down from the surface, those are the sort of provisionally positioned drill holes, and each one of them is 200 meters because it assumes that we'll be using that very lightweight rig. And, you know, just to reiterate Keith's point about the porphyries being important on this vertical slice, obviously with a 200-meter range on our rig, we can't really get down to the porphyries, but we should see the sort of onion-shaped rings of alteration around the porphyries. So even with that shallow drilling, we should have good evidence that the porphyries are there. And then there is a sort of intermediate weight rig that weighs about 200 kilos more than the very lightweight one that can drill to 800 meters, owned by the same company. And so as soon as we get evidence that we need to keep drilling deeper for those porphyries, we can bring in that rig there as well. But back to the cost side, the lightweight rig is one of the reasons that we're using it, is obviously for ease of logistics, but secondly, the drill rates do come down, or the cost of drilling is minimized. Any other questions?
We have one more question from Mark Reichman with Noble Capital Partners. Please go ahead.
Yeah, just a quick follow-up. But first, before I ask my question, I did want to commend the company for providing resources and supplies to the local communities in Ecuador during the pandemic. So I thought that was deserving of calling that out. But the question I have is really centered on page 7 of the slide presentation. You know, you've talked about the 20 epithermal targets. And I think this is kind of the first slide I've seen in your presentations where you've kind of grouped them in the concept of belts. And so I thought maybe you could, you know, provide a little color on kind of how you're thinking about these now. And then in terms of the 20 epithermal targets, you know, which are your highest priority at this point? And I know there had been some talk about maybe moving the drill from Yowie to Tiria, you know, and how that, you know, how you see things progressing there.
Thanks, Mark. Keith, do you want to take this?
Yeah, you know, I've actually played around with this image a bit, and if you were to superimpose it on Yellowstone National Park, where we know that there's all these this tremendous number of geothermal areas and hot springs, it's around the same. You know, you can see the scale bar at the bottom of this image. 20 kilometers. This is a huge, massive, massive belt. There are not many things like this, even today in the modern era. You know, this is probably evidence of what we would call a super volcano that existed back in the Jurassic. So we're talking around the time of the dinosaurs, when all these geothermal areas were active. So there's an incredible diverse number of different targets here. Now, you know, we're still developing this. I mean, Richard's got his favorites. I've got my favorites. And I still very much like Yowie. And I think we need to do some more work there. But Tiria Shimpia might be a little bit of a different beast, because it appears to be a similar sort of thing like Yowie, but maybe something that's been eroded down a bit deeper to expose mineralization. What we really need to do is get the geologist in there banging rocks and really get to grips with what's going on. You know, this is heavy jungle. It needs boots on the ground and people with good observational skills and experienced geologists to find and recognize this stuff. Really, this is a, you know, I call it a huge smorgasbord of targets. It really is quite incredible. Now, what we want to do, And we said it elsewhere in the presentation. We want to do CSAMT, which is an electrical geophysical method, and we're looking for resistant zones at depth. So these would be zones that are flooded by silica, and they tend to be things that it's not easy to pass electric current through them, so they show up as zones of resistance on a geophysical survey. This technique has been used with great efficacy in other parts of the world. I don't know if it's been used in Ecuador yet. Maybe it has, but similar sorts of techniques were certainly used at Fruta del Norte and picked up the mineralization. It's a little bit subtle there, but in any case, we think the information from that technique, adding to what we've already got from the drilling that we've done, is going to much better target our drilling in the future.
And Keith, if I could just add to that, Mark, in La Torre, in that La Torre belt, and it's very interesting to see these three belts coming out, that sort of north west southeast orientation is a very important orientation in this area, or in the adjacent area to the south, which is part of the same belt anyway. And we know that those structures are fertile, that they were the plumbing system for these Jurassic systems. But in the La Torre belt, where Crunchy and Yowie, and in fact Apai, are located, all of those are very high level. They've got lots of sinter, very much a Yellowstone National Park kind of setting, as Keith mentioned. The geophysics shows, when we originally saw the geophysics, we said, well, there is a great big hole in that area that's, about 20 kilometers in diameter. And, we sort of joked and said, well, that's got to be some sort of volcanic event. And then we sort of laughed it off, but now we're coming back. The more we see these diatreme systems, and we actually are seeing quite a clear relationship between the volcanics at Crunchy Hill and Yowie, we are beginning to think that original salt was probably right, that there was one big sort of Yellowstone type caldera under Apai, Yowie, and Crunchy. The good thing about seeing the sinters on surface is it means the entire epithermal system is preserved. The flip side of that is that it's they are more complicated targets because the sinter obviously extends much further than the actual vein systems underneath them, and that we've tried to illustrate that on page 8. But as Keith mentioned, that Tiriashimpia belt, we originally downgraded it because we weren't seeing many sinter blocks, and we were really excited about the sinters. And we're now realizing that, hey, that actually means that the sinter was eroded off, and we're in that couple of hundred meters that is typically between the sinter and the gold-bearing parts of the system. And, as Keith mentioned, I mean, the scale of this stuff is a little mind-boggling. Tiriashimpia is a belt that is 15 kilometers long. And in fact, we haven't seen the end of it yet. We're seeing a very a structure, which would be the plumbing system for the metal-bearing fluids coming right up through the middle of it. And, one of the reasons that we are thinking of focusing it at Tiria is that, the soil sampling is lighting up. It's lighting up along these faults. And so it's very easy to see what the structure is. Between Tiria South and Tiria East, there's 7 kilometers that we know nothing about, apart from the fact that the fault that lights up in the soil geochem on the one end also lights up at 7 kilometers away on the other. So, rather than having to use expensive geophysics and all that kind of thing, it's just easy to get in there with soil crews and do the basic soil sampling to get a very simple target that's easy to drill kind of thing. So, you know, that's one of the plans. So at La Torre, in the La Torre belt, we're waiting for the geophysics crews to come in. They would be probably from a Mexican group, so we're waiting for you know, the international flights and all that to start up. Whereas you know, Tiria and Chimpia, we can get in there with the field team sort of straight away. And the idea is to have targets that are very easy that you can literally put your foot on and say, okay, let's drill underneath this. Any other questions?
We've got a question from Ron Savage with the Scott Group. Please go ahead.
Yeah, this is Ron Savage here. Thanks, Keith and Richard, for answering these questions. My question sort of relates to the previous discussion on cash flow and burn rate. I think, Richard, you mentioned that you probably have about a 10-month horizon without any need for additional capital so far. But I noticed that with the Vicus project, if these concessions are approved, there'll be concession fees probably in excess of $1 million for that. Does that suggest a separate round of financing for that?
Ron, look, I mean, you know, we were being a little opportunistic on the Peru side. You know, we believe, look, at the beginning, we did not expect to find the sedimentary hosted copper silver in Ecuador. It was unknown from Ecuador. We stumbled across it. We walked across it in the field because our geos were the first guys in this area. Has never been explored before. And, you know, we decided that we felt that we were onto something big and new. And we looked across the border where the geology continues in Peru, and we thought, you know, if we don't take up that ground or apply for that ground, we're going to kick ourselves forevermore. And, you know, thanks to Keith putting up the cash for it, we were able to do that. You know, we were already talking about the scale of our targets in Ecuador and them being big already. Add Peru to that, and it becomes, you know, it becomes an even bigger project, obviously. So, you know, we are we're being cautious about what we're doing in Peru. In Peru, there is a lot more data available. There's a huge amount of seismic data available. There's the geophysics, the magnetics that we had to fly in Ecuador because that data wasn't available. That is available in Peru. So basically, on the basis of desk studies, we can make some huge advances in Peru at a very modest cost. Coming to your point about the fees that would have to be paid mid next year for the Peru ground, let's just clarify that you know, we would probably end up dropping quite a lot of the ground that we've applied for once we get the data, and we're working with that data at the moment. But you know, the thing is that we do expect interest from majors. I think that anyone who sees the same sort of picture that we are seeing on the Ecuadorian side of the border with what some of the other companies are putting out in Peru are going to come to the same conclusion that we did. That, you know, if we are right, there's an unprecedented opportunity here, or an opportunity that, if it's not unprecedented, it doesn't come very often in one's lifetime. The majors are going to switch on to that, and I think that the majors are in a situation where they don't want to be the group that missed out on an opportunity like this. So we expect a little bit of competitive tension to develop between now and the time that those concession fees have to be paid.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. I might add, sorry, go ahead, Keith, if I can. You know, this is like a ripe plum waiting to be picked. It was just too compelling, and we knew that copper silver had been found in Peru, in the same geological unit, in the same geological setting that we found it in Ecuador. So it was really a no-brainer. Because geology does not stop at political boundaries, take the search across the border, and you know, in kind of a, well, I suppose in some ways you can call it opportunistic, but this is the way our exploration works. We saw an opportunity here, and it was open ground, so we filed on it. I know that in that area of Peru, it doesn't have the same jungle cover as we're experiencing in Ecuador. It's a lot more open country. There's a lot more outcrop on the surface. So it is possible that we could potentially move things along there very much faster than in Ecuador. But by the time the time rolls around to pay for any concessions in Peru, we will have drilling done on the copper and silver and sediments on our Ecuadorian side of the border, and that will add a tremendous amount of information for us, proprietary information. We're not going to share it, but it's stuff that's going to be strategic for us that we can apply across the border into Peru.
Very interesting. Well, let's keep our fingers crossed. By the way, am I pronouncing it right? Is it Vicus?
Yeah. Well, Vicus, yeah.
Vicus.
Vicus. Vicus.
It's Latin.
All right, thank you.
Our next question comes from Terrence Ortsland with TSO. Please go ahead.
Thank you, operator. Just thanks, guys, for the presentation. Just continuing on the Vicus property, it looks like from the database that exists on the map here, I can't get the color code in the legend versus the map itself, but it looks like you got less than 5% of the total property you applied concessions for. What about the other 95%? Other people applied for it, or is it just still open?
No. Terry, we looked very carefully at that. In fact, the guy, the specialist out of the UK who did the original interpretation of the geology from the satellite imagery and AFTA and all the rest on the Ecuadorian side of the border, and did a really phenomenal job. I mean, he really opened our eyes on the Ecuadorian side of the border. Before we took up that ground in Peru, we asked Mike Baker to do that interpretation and to identify, and obviously we had fed back to him the results of our sedimentary hosted stuff because, you know, as I say, it was unexpected. And as the results came in on the Ecuadorian side of the border, we were feeding that back to him saying, hey, you know, can you tweak your interpretation on the Ecuadorian side to, you know, to help us home in on the prospective, the most prospective areas for the red bed hosted copper or the sedimentary hosted copper on the Ecuadorian side. So, you know, Mike was he had all the information, and so we asked him to take a look at the Peruvian side of the border, And knowing the stratigraphic position or the position in the sedimentary layering where we had seen the mineralization on the Ecuadorian side of the border, Mike outlined those areas where that layer was likely to be closest to surface and where he could see it in the imagery. So, you know, we have, look, there is some of the ground is taken by other companies, juniors, but in fact, the vast majority of it was open. And you know, it was taken up on that in-house interpretation. So we basically took up all the ground that we felt was compelling. You know, obviously some of the ground that we wanted was taken by other companies, but we basically got just about everything. I would say 95% of what we wanted we were able to get. So that ground position that's shown on that graphic on page 19 is basically everything that we wanted. The big holes out of it, there are some national parks in there and that kind of thing, and that's why between the sort of Ecuadorian border and you know, lining up with the southern part of the Ecuadorian border, there is a big gap in there, and that gap is because there's a national park in there.
On the Peruvian side.
On the Peruvian side, right?
Richard, the continuing on this, nobody has been approved or granted the concessions yet. You or the other companies or the other juniors?
No, the other juniors, they started staking ages before we did, and in fact, you know, obviously it was their results that made us realize that, you know, we were seeing something that literally on the scale of a couple of hundred kilometers. You know, so they were at this probably a year before we were on the Peruvian side of the border. So they're well ahead of us in the process. And you know, on the Peruvian side, the granting process or the concession granting process takes a long time. It, you know, it can be in the order of a year. And in fact, with the COVID situation, Peru is in serious lockdown. And you know, so it's probably going to be a little bit longer than that. However, you know, we are allowed to get into the field, we are allowed to prospect, we're just not allowed to drill before the concessions are actually granted. But you know, as I say, you know, what we've got to do is focus on the seismic, which gives us the three-dimensional side to all these basins. And you know, I think that one of the things that we're bringing from the Ecuadorian side of the border is these porphyries. You know, no one on the Peruvian side of the border is talking about porphyries in this belt. And, you know, wherever we look in Ecuador, we're seeing porphyries. So, in fact, on the seismic sections that we've seen on the Peruvian side of the border, you know, the oil-orientated guys who are interpreting those seismic sections, they have many, many, many salt domes. And, you know, undoubtedly a lot of them are salt domes, but there are others that we think are probably porphyries that are being directly imaged in the seismic. And, you know, we're just bringing that knowledge from the other side of the border. So really, really exciting things to happen on the Peruvian side.
So there is no pressure to spend serious money on this thing until the concessions are granted?
No, and you know, I think the wise course of action is to look at, you know, these massive data sets that there are already. And in fact, you know, there's even some stream sediment sampling over some of the concession areas, and which we're looking at, obviously.
Just we're doing the global exploration figures for 2020. And we see that we'll be seeing another 30% decline around the globe. That will be almost 15, 16-year low, looking at about less than $7 billion from about $9.5, $10 billion last year. What will be the expected number in Ecuador this year, not only you, but totally in the country, would you say?
Kerry, absolutely no idea. However, you know, just in the last couple of weeks, we've seen some serious money raised for Ecuadorian projects. I mean, you know, all the big financings in the resource space have been Ecuador-centric in the last couple of weeks. Not only Lundin with the $50 million, you know, SolGold raised, I think it was $35 million or so. Solaris raised $20 million for their copper project just on our southern boundary, and there was someone else for $10 million. So, for whatever reason, Ecuador seems to be the flavor of the month. And interestingly, you know, a lot of those financings were copper orientated. So I think it bodes well for interest in the country. And and, you know, obviously we wish those companies all the success, because the more success they have, the more we have. So.
Exactly. It's going to increase the premium being in the country. Just continuing on that, I'm sure a lot of people watching you corporate-wise as well as the market and the shareholders and all. And are you making your data available to people, to companies that are interested in making any deals with you at this moment in time? I think you got a great problem ahead of you, because you got such great properties and such diligent work. I wish that all the money is available for you to do those things, but at some point in time, you have to make some strategic decisions about possibly let some partners come in, either commodity base or area base, and raise more money and focus on the things you want. I don't think the time is right now. Maybe it's a bit later, but what do you think about that scenario in terms of going ahead, in terms of timing?
And Terry, all I can say to that is yes, we have a data room that's open. We have people in that data room, and you know, these big companies, it takes them a little while. Well, generally, quite a while to take a decision. And you know, obviously, those confidentiality agreements under which they're accessing the data, you know, we can't say who those companies are. That's confidential. And but the answer to your question is yes, people are looking. Keith, I don't know if you want to add anything there.
Yeah, you know, I think there's been a real sea change, and it's come about now that Fruta del Norte declared commercial production in February. Of course, they're all back to work now, but they were kind of at limited with what they could do with the COVID because of the mandated lockdown. But in any case, they reached commercial production in February. Their all-in sustaining cost for an ounce of gold is something like I think $980, so they're coining money, and they're able to get their concentrate, their gold concentrate, off-site. It's going to Finland, where it's being processed, and they're also producing doré gold-silver bars on-site, and, you know, they're doing it. And, gosh, you know, when I was part of the group running Aurelian, we were told a thousand times by different people that it was impossible and it could not be done. And here's the proof. And I think this has opened up people's eyes to the possibilities in Ecuador. The other thing is that Reni Ortiz, who is the Minister for Non-Renewable Resources and Energy, he has done three webinars in the last month or so. This is kind of unprecedented for a minister in Ecuador. And he's saying, look, you know, the oil price has been smashed. They've depended on oil to generate the income for the country for decades. And really what they have to do is fast track the mining scene. And he's been talking about developing logistical corridors to help, you know, develop infrastructure. There is a proposal for a 3.5 gigawatt hydroelectric dam that's only less than 50 k's away from our property. And that has been revived. It's been mothballed for a number of years. And why? It's because Ecuador is now making $100 million a year selling hydroelectric power to Colombia. And so they're looking for alternatives to raise cash, and the mining business is the alternative. It's the best alternative. These things have sat in the ground for too darn long. So they're going to pull out the stops, and even if the government changes, the next government that comes in is going to have to be committed because, you know, they essentially need the revenue. So I think this is one of the reasons why all this money has been raised just in this very, very short period of time, you know, and on the back of the COVID pandemic. It's astounding for me. But there's a lot of projects in Ecuador that are poised to get the green lights and start building.
I think every country wants to see exploration activity and development activity. One thing that they don't want to see is that companies selling the assets to somebody else at a higher price and they make all the money. And there's always a sensitive issue with the governments. That's why I was asking you about the exploration expenditures this year in the countries and what they were in activity. From what we know, and I'm sure you can confirm, almost like everybody we know, from Australians to North Americans, either they are there or they're keeping an eye on the assets and the exploration development. But the biggest spender so far, as far as we know, is the Soul Gold. Am I right?
Yeah, that's correct. And they have been talking about putting their Alpala project in production themselves. I must admit I'm a bit skeptical about that plan. It's going to take a lot of money, and I don't know if they even have the expertise to contemplate building a mine. It's not the sort of thing that I would consider. And, Terry, I must say, I think you're a little bit wrong when you say that the government doesn't want to see the companies make the money. I understand that. But for the first time, they are starting to realize that it's not major companies that find the deposits. And I saw a number just last week, 65% of the discoveries being made worldwide right now are made by junior companies. And we all know that the junior companies are kind of the seedbed for the projects, and then the companies get bought out. And, with this massive property and all the different targets and the stuff in Peru, we have a lot of optionality here. And as Richard has said, we do have a data room, and so we're open to discuss pretty much any approach that benefits our shareholders to forward our projects. But I think at the end of the day, and realistically, juniors rarely ever are able to pull off building a mine. And doing it efficiently and properly and profitably. So I think what will happen, SolGold at the end of the day is a public company, and already both Newcrest and BHP have big chunks of it. And I would suspect myself, and this is just my opinion, that one or other of them, or maybe even somebody else, will just gobble them one day.
Let's hope that the activity will continue. Thanks, guys.
Thank you,
Barry.
Any other questions?
Once again, if you have a question, please press star, then one. There are no more questioners in queue. This concludes the question and answer session. I would like to turn the conference back over to Dr. Keith Barron and Dr. Richard Spencer for any closing remarks.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for your attendance. It's getting late. It's 9:45 in the evening here in Europe, and But I thank you. Probably there have been people on the call internationally from all over the place. So you've heard what we've got to say, and please follow the story. We appreciate your support, and we're not going to disappoint. Thank you. Richard?
Thanks, Keith. Yeah, thank you for your support. And you know, please, if there are questions that you weren't able to get through on the line or anything that was unclear, please just contact us. The contact info is on page 20, and Carolyn is far more efficient than any of the rest of us at you know, getting the info and getting back to you and prompting us and all that. So please, you know, we would love to hear from you, and yeah, we'll always try to answer the questions. Thanks very much.
This concludes today's conference call. You may disconnect your lines. Thank you for participating and have a pleasant day.